This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In December of last year, Clayton Wilcox was chosen to succeed Ann Clark as superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. He came to town frequently in the first 6 months of the year to get the lay of the land, meet the players, and to listen, learn, and offer input on key decisions that would involve his tenure going forward. Dr. Wilcox officially took the reins 6.5 weeks ago on July 1st, and now that he's had some time to settle in, and just before the start of a school year, we've asked him to join us for an hour so that we could get to know him and his vision for the schools and more. Dr. Wilcox, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Welcome to Charlotte. If you'd like to join our conversation, and I'm sure you will because it's about education and everybody jumps in, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook, where we're broadcasting on Facebook Live, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Yours is, and we just talked about this off the air, yours is an insanely difficult job. And I suppose it's that way in any school system, and you've worked in several. Why would you want this job?
Well, you know, honestly, for me, it's about kids. It's about young people. And I just believe, with every fiber of my soul, that education is the key to kind of writing some of the things that are happening within our society. It's the way that we give young people the opportunity to be more than they believe they can be. So that's why I do it. You know, I say all the time to leaders and community members, sometimes they understand, sometimes they don't, that I have one constituency, and my constituency is the young people of Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system.
But I've heard I've been here since 1985, and I've interviewed every single person who's sat in your office during all those years, and they all say that, and they don't last all that long. They either leave because they get a better opportunity, or because they're asked to leave in one case, or something else goes on, and they move on to better opportunities. Always with the kids in mind, though.
Yeah. Well, I think it is hard. It's a job that is somewhat unforgiving. If you make a decision that impacts one group in a disparate way, or in a way that they perceive diminishes them in some way, then oftentimes the political powers begin to move and people are either forced to leave or they choose to leave. You know, it is a job also that takes a great deal of time and energy from your family. You really don't have any days that you're not asked to be somewhere or that you're not participating in some conversation. So it's pretty consuming.
What kind of homework did you do on us? What did you know and what were your impressions of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools before the interview process or during the interview process?
Well, it's interesting because when I was a superintendent in Pinellas County, which is really a like-sized district in Florida, yes, we always looked at Charlotte as kind of that bright shining light, a place where people were getting it done. When I was in Baton Rouge, we also looked here because we were enmeshed in a deep desegregation conversation, and we were watching what was taking place in Charlotte. So for the past 15 or 20 years, I've actually been looking at Charlotte from afar, and that lens has always been really a very clear lens and a lens that kind of shined a light on a school system that was getting it right. I also am proud to say that I have a number of friends who have been the superintendent here. Pete Gorman in particular is somebody who I had gotten to know when he was in Tustin, California, prior to coming here, and then I watched his tenure here. So, you know, I did look at the school system, and then when I got involved in the search process, I really started to look much more closely at, you know, disparate treatment of students in terms of our discipline policies. I looked at the achievement gaps. I looked at how the city was reacting with the schools and ultimately decided it was still a place that I wanted to be.
I think people don't understand that. We keep hearing that from people from the outside, that Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools are like a beacon in the darkness out there. We're an example, a shining example. And I don't know whether people actually believe that about us. And I've heard it from outsiders now for years.
You know, I understand that, Mike. I think, you know, unless you're from somewhere else, you probably won't believe it because your experience sometimes dictates your belief system. I will tell you, having been a superintendent in three other school districts, what's going on here is really some great work on behalf of kids.
What is going on here that makes it so great then? What is it? What's happening here? Well, what don't we see because we're here in the middle of it?
I don't think people see how engaged this community is in its schools in a positive, productive dialogue. That regardless of whether you're at a small elementary school in the outskirts of Mecklenburg County or whether you're right here near the city, there are parents, there are community members, there are business owners who are invested in the success of the kids here. I don't think people see that. I don't think people really understand how many people are engaged.
Are we invested in the success of all the children, or are we invested in the success of some of the children? And by that I mean there are a lot of kids, particularly from lower socioeconomic tracts, that fall through the cracks here.
I think that's true. I think it's arguable whether every kid in the school system gets the same quality of education, whether somebody in one of the city schools gets the same education as somebody in the suburban schools. But that's really my role, is to try to equalize that playing field for all kids. And, you know, quite honestly, back to the first question, that's one of the reasons I'm here, because I do believe that that's important work. And I don't believe that there are many people in the country who have the demonstrated record of making that kind of change for kids that I do. So I'm excited to come here, and I'm excited to do that work.
You've been described as an innovator and one with a passion for making sure students of poverty aren't neglected, and for creating boutique schools that help teens explore their passions. Let's talk about both of those things. First, your passion for helping students to read, because that's a thing that you really have focused on in the past, I'm told, and not neglecting lower-income students. Is reading the crux of everything?
I think that it is. In fact, you know, I've gotten myself into some fairly heated discussions around a civil rights issue because I've equated reading as the civil rights issue of the 21st century. And that's not to denigrate anybody who is talking about some of the other really important issues of our time. But I believe that if you can't read, you're not going to be able to compete. You're not going to be able to achieve in the 21st century. Reading is the foundational skill that everyone has to have.
You're condemning yourself to a lower socioeconomic life if you can't read.
I think that's absolutely true. You won't be able to avail yourself to any of the options that we want.
And when do we lose students? When do the ones that we lose, the ones that cannot read, the ones that get through high school and you look at what they've written and you can't understand it because it's syntactically incorrect and there's no punctuation and the spelling is all over the place. It's clear they can't read because they can't write. What happened to those kids? When did we lose them and why?
I think the sad reality is we've lost them even before they enter school. Oftentimes kids come from an environment where, you know, there is no connection to the real world in terms of real words. You know, you've got parents who say, shut up, sit down, be quiet. They don't really let kids explore the language. You look in some of our grocery stores today when parents say, don't touch that, and you contrast that against the parents who are saying, oh, well, that's, you know, eggplant, and that my dad likes that with, you know, a Parmesan, a special sauce with it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just a desert of words for some kids, and so when they come to school, they're not really prepared to understand the language.
So is the public school system equipped to deal with that deficit?
Wow, that's a tough question. You know, I think we are equipped, but I think we have to really, really reallocate some of our resources to help those kids who are most in need. I think, you know, there's no substitute for great parenting. As a school system, we're not going to be great parents to the kids. But I think we have the foundational skills to teach reading to kids. But then what we need, if we're really going to have those kids be all that they can be, is parents who support that, community members who support that.
Mm-hmm. Some of these parents can't read.
Well, that's true. That's what makes the work really difficult.
Should they be helped in some way?
I absolutely think that's true. You know, I think our good friends at the community colleges are doing some of that work. We're doing some of that work. The library here is doing some of that work. I think everybody has kind of come to the recognition that, you know, all boats have to rise if we're really going to turn this thing around.
So what are teen-focused boutique schools? Are they magnet schools? What are they?
Well, they could be magnet schools, but more often than not, what it is that when we find an interest that kids have, we organize the learning around that. So if a young person comes and, for example, they're interested in auto mechanics, we make sure that those kids have not only an opportunity to experiment with engines and the dynamics that make a car, but we also make sure that their traditional learning supports that as well. So, you know, when we're talking math, we might be talking about how fuel is injected into the engine and using combustion rates or gear ratios to help them understand mathematics. So boutique learning really is about taking where kids are passionate and then finding a way to make sure that they learn what they need to know to be successful through that.
So if they're a gamer, and a lot of kids are gamers now, if they're a gamer, you can find a way to get to them through their hobby?
Oh, absolutely. We can begin to talk to them about coding. We can talk about the mathematics behind that. We can talk about the science behind technology. There's just a lot of things we can do. But you have to have an imagination. You have to open your mind to what the kids are into.
Right. In talking with WCNC-TV about the conversations that you observed about the student assignment plan, which will roll out, I think, next year, but that you were kind of observing the conversations, before you took over, you told them that your predecessor, Ann Clark, had a, this is a quote, good and gracious style. I have a different style. What is that style?
I think I'm probably someone who is possessed by more of an urgent spirit. What that means is that I'm going to push a little bit harder perhaps than Mrs. Clark did. I'm probably not going to be as understanding when we fail to meet the expectations that have been set. I will be dignified in that. I won't be a yeller or a screamer, but I think my team would be quick to tell you that I'm going to set an expectation, we're going to hold people to it and hold them accountable for achieving it.
How do you do that and not create what one of your predecessors is accused of creating, and that is a culture of fear?
Well, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that I have kind of talked about is that we have to create a culture that allows our strategy. And that culture has to be a smart culture. It has to be a culture that's accepting. But it also has to be, you know, I think mutually understood that accountability has consequences. Now, you don't need to be disagreeable about that, but you need to lay out clear benchmarks for people, have conversations in between that make some sense, and, you know, just continue to talk.
You've been the superintendent, I believe, of three other systems around the country, Pinellas, this system in Baton Rouge, and, of course, most recently in Hagerstown, Maryland, which is really a bedroom suburb of Washington, D.C. now, believe it or not, for people who don't know the area. It's pretty far away, but people live there and work in D.C. You've been in those systems for about 3 to 5 years, depending upon which system we're talking about, and you've said that you'd like to be here until you retire for 9 or 10 years, and you said that in Pinellas County, and I believe you said it in Hagerstown. Is that realistic? Is the average tenure of a superintendent anywhere in the country is pretty short?
It is. You know, it's funny, and again, I have to be careful how I say this, but I've teased people saying that superintendents are the highest paid migrant workers in America. You can't predict the future. I think you go into every environment saying that this is where you want to be, but the landscape changes. And if you really, I think, are pushing change and you're pushing the comfort level of people, at some point people tire of that a little bit. And sometimes you get tired of pushing the ball up the hill. So, you know, I will tell you that I love Pinellas County. It was a great place to be. We had a beautiful home and a great community. Our kids were growing up there. I probably would have stayed for a long, long time. Yeah. But elections have consequences. School boards change. And communities change.
Right. What, and we only have a minute left in this segment, but what do you see as the biggest challenge that you face at CMS?
I believe it's the inspiration gap. I think it is that many of our young people aren't inspired to achieve. I think that has to be accomplished by great teachers in classrooms who know their content and create a picture that the young people are kind of compelled towards.
Mm. Do we have great teachers?
I think top to bottom, we have a lot of really very good teachers, and we have some great teachers.
Okay. Dr. Clayton Wilcox, we have so much to talk about. He's the new superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. School hasn't started yet, but it's about to, and the buses will be auditioning on Monday.
On Monday morning, very early.
No kids in them, just practice runs for the bus system. So just be aware of that. We're going to come back and talk more about CMS and about the challenges ahead, and Dr. Clayton Wilcox himself in just a moment on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and TRCW, a specialty shop for women built and headquartered in Charlotte, featuring American and European clothing and accessories for women of discriminating taste, located in Phillips Place, trcstyle.com. And Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, located at The View near BB&T Ballpark in Uptown Charlotte, and at Brookdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wine and beer from all over the world. Relax, uncork, unwind. TheScrewCrew.com. Violence over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, sets off a new conversation about race and racist symbols, what our politicians are saying. Governor Cooper says that all Confederate monuments in the state should come down. Charlotte School of Law is coming down. It's no more after the American Bar Association denies plans to move forward, and the eclipse is coming, and so are the tourists. Those stories and more on our local news roundup tomorrow, coming to you from the Charlotte Observer, tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Gelton. Coming up on the next On Point, white supremacists think they've got a president who understands them. We dig deep into the supremacist movement in America today. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point from 10 till noon following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Clayton Wilcox is our guest. He's the new Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Superintendent, took over on July the 1st, spent a good part of the first 6 months of this year here, watching, listening, meeting people, putting in his 2 cents worth here and there where he was asked, and now he's running the show, so to speak. It is said, or you have said, that you have certain things at the top of your to-do list now that you're here. Among them, the need to modernize both school buildings and content. Teachers need to become more proficient in digital instruction, you have said, and students with disabilities should get a more effective education. Why did you decide on those goals at the top of the list?
Well, let me start with the last one first, okay. Because I really have looked carefully into some of the needs of some of our special needs students. In the district, we call them EC students, exceptional children. Mm-hmm. Special education cannot be a sentence. It's got to be a service. We've got to work harder, I think, at helping young people who are challenged or differently abled be successful. They are going to have some of the most difficult lives to lead. I think we have to spend a great deal of time helping those kids and helping those families. I think we will be known as a school system by the services that we provide to those families in particular. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that, you know, in the 21st century, your interaction with others, your interaction with business and industry oftentimes is going to be around technology. So we have to help create kids who are sophisticated digital consumers. We have to make sure that they understand that all the stuff that they see swirling around the internet is not true. They've got to find a way to make some sense out of what really sometimes feels almost insane.
So it's media or digital literacy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the ability to interact with that, mm-hmm. because quite honestly, we've moved beyond a place where a few possessed all the knowledge. We have to make that really ubiquitous with every citizen's ability to interact. Just like turning on and off the light, you've got to be able to interact with these media sources and make sure you determine that they're credible.
But aren't kids better at that than the teachers, than the adults?
I think sometimes people say that, but oftentimes kids really demonstrate a real lack of care in terms of where they go and what they do. It's funny because I watch my own son and daughter sometimes interact with media, and all of a sudden, you know, they're starting to say that I want to live this life of the rich and famous, but they don't realize that it's a lease payment on that Lamborghini in the front. It's not owned. They're staging a big house or a mansion. Mm-hmm. The party that they're throwing is underwritten by somebody else. It's not their lifestyle, yet my kids sometimes believe that it is. So that's why I'm saying they've got to be a sophisticated consumer. And then the last topic, we announced yesterday that we are moving forward with the bond initiative for $922 million, which is the largest bond referendum in the Charlotte area's history. We need this resource, and we need it because we have to create spaces for our young people that are really worthy of them and also allow us to teach kids in a 21st century manner. We don't teach kids in nice, neat boxes anymore. We integrate subjects like biology and chemistry. We teach biochemistry now. Mathematics is not taught devoid of physics, so we've got to have spaces that align with that. We use all kinds of new technologies in schools to help kids. You know, virtual dissection rather than actually dissecting a pig's heart or a pig's eye.
Thank you, by the way.
Well, you're welcome.
Because I had to do that in high school, and it was not pleasant.
I had to dissect a cat at Drake University, and that just wasn't cool. You know, take it back to your dorm room and hang it out your window.
So let's get to the modernization part, because that's involved in the bonds. And I had 937. What did you say?
922, I believe, okay. After it's all amateurized.
Okay. And that's much of that money is earmarked for a physical plant, for modernization, for changing things?
All of that money is. We're going to build, I believe, 17 either new or replacement facilities. We have a significant number of renovations and remodeling projects as well.
Do you see this as most school bonds traditionally have passed in this market, in this city? Do you see this as a test of your leadership to get these bonds passed or not?
You know, I know that I have a role in this, but I'm not sure that I don't think people know me well enough to know whether their vote says yes, we like him as our superintendent, or no, we don't.
Right.
What I do know is I have a deep responsibility to get out and tell the community what it is they're voting for, why we need this. I can't advocate on behalf of how you should vote, but I think I can help to educate that.
Shortly after you arrived, you heard criticism of CMS from some county commissioners who said voters will not allocate more money to renovate schools that the system doesn't seem to care about. You commented on needing to give these schools a more manicured appearance. You even jumped on a lawnmower yourself to cut the grass at one of these schools. As an outsider who just recently arrived with fresh eyes, is the appearance of our schools subpar?
I think it is in many cases, but it's not because of the hard work of talented men and women. It's really if people would go back and look at where we've had to make budget cuts since the recession, they would see that we're tens of millions of dollars less in money to support the renovation, the maintenance of our schools. Most recently, the last 2 years, the county commissioners have provided 18 additional millions beyond the formula to help us, and I think we're starting to see the first fruits of that labor. But I think, yeah, we can do a better job. I think if you go to our schools today, it's very clear that we're doing a better job than we were doing even 6 months ago. Part of that is because we have the resources to do it, but part of it is because of this kind of renewed call to action that, you know, Commissioner Puckett and some of the others brought to light.
Does it all boil down to money? I mean, is there enough money? Because, you know, I don't know how familiar you are with the process. I'm sure you've been told that the process is actually backward here. I think you never know what you're going to have in your operating budget until it's too late to make the changes necessary to deal with the money you're going to be given. It should be the other way around. But is there enough money?
You know, I think you can always use more money in a situation like this, but we also have to be responsible to our taxpayers. We've got to demonstrate that we know how to do the work. But let me give you one example of that. So this year we asked for about $28 million from the county commissioners. There were some commissioners who believed that we were asking for more than what we needed. That was not the case. We had very carefully looked at the money that we needed, and we made, I thought, a reasonable and responsible request. They didn't fund it. And then we were about, I don't know, $11 or $12 million short of what we needed to do. So we had to make some decisions. And those decisions were not going to be able to add the number of guidance counselors and social workers that we need to deal with some of the changes in our climate.
You know, the public schools in America have served this country well for decades, although people don't admit it anymore. There's a segment of the population who doesn't admit it anymore. And in recent years, public schools have fallen under a great deal of criticism, some deserved, some not. How much of that criticism is warranted in your view?
Well, I think some is warranted. I think we have perhaps slipped down kind of a slippery slope towards, rather than telling the truth about our history, we've watered that down a little bit, and I think we're seeing some of the consequences of those kinds of decisions.
When you say our history, are you talking about American history or the history of public education?
I'm talking about American history. I think that's but one example. On the other hand, if you take a look at what we're doing in terms of mathematics today, we're teaching mathematics at a higher level than I think schools have ever taught. It's a challenging area to be in because, you know, people from both sides can come out with competing facts. But the reality is we're being asked to do more than we've ever done before. You know, I'm fond of telling this story that, you know, people who refer to the good old days, I'm not sure that they were really there, because if they looked to their right and left today, they would see kids that weren't there. They would see women who weren't being well served. They would see black students or Latino students who weren't there before, who had been excluded. They would even be seeing some of their white compatriots who didn't do well in school that were dropping out.
I've been taken to task because I've said that kids today don't learn history. They don't learn civics. They don't learn how the country works, how the government works, how it's supposed to work. And I've been taken to task by people in the classroom who say, yes, we do. That's exactly what we do. We teach that every single day. You're wrong. And you just said that we kind of gloss over or dumb down or simplify American history. Now, we have had over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, white supremacists and neo-Nazis parading in the streets. Take the violence aside. This country fought a war. Hundreds of thousands of lives were lost to defeat Hitler's Nazi Party in Germany. And these people are neo-Nazis in this country. Is that, do you think, because they really believe what Hitler's Nazi Party was about? Or is it because they don't understand fascism?
I think it's the latter. I think they don't understand what fascism is. And I think many of those folks, had they known what they were standing for or beside in this, would have rethought. It might not have changed any of their behavior, but clearly they wouldn't have identified with that type of terror.
Mm-hmm. Are we asking the public schools, and I've asked a lot of superintendents this question, are we asking them to do too much? Because today we're not just asking you to educate kids.
No.
We're asking you to feed them. We're asking you to catch them up on early childhood education that they didn't get in their home. We're asking you to take care of kids who, once they leave the classroom, which could be the safest place they've been all day, they have to go back into an environment that's not safe, it's not nurturing, it's difficult to survive, much less do homework in.
You know, we kidded about before we started the story, but I'd give you, you know, some longer answers or some short answers. To this answer, I can just say, yes, we're asking the schools to do too much. You know, we can't be the parents of young people. We can't be the source of their spirituality. We can't be the source of really their understanding of right or wrong. I mean, that really has to begin at home and has to be reinforced by the community in which they live. To the extent that we have to spend time doing those things, that's time we can't spend on teaching the reality of our history as Americans or our history as a country. That's time we can't spend talking about, you know, how science is relevant in their lives. So I think you're absolutely onto something, and you're correct in that we have been asked over time to do too much.
So what's the answer? Who does that? If the schools don't do it, who will?
Well, I think right now where we are in American society is the schools have to do it. It's something that now we have to do. We have a generation of parents and perhaps several generations of parents who never were adequately prepared themselves, and now to ask them to do something that they're not prepared to do really begs the question of can they? So I think we have to do some of that. But at the same time, we have to be very conscious that we're not trying to indoctrinate kids into a way of thinking, but rather trying to help them.
Are we teaching children, particularly in the upper grades, once they learn the basics, are we teaching them how to think critically? Or are we creating a generation after generation of people that are designed to be robots? Just go to work, do what you're told. Get off at 5 o'clock, party.
You know, I think that pendulum has swung a little bit. I think we've moved from that to teaching more critical thinking. We are asking kids to be more thoughtful about what they're reading or seeing. As we referenced earlier when we were talking about kids and technology, I think you're seeing more and more teachers today asking kids to be critical consumers, asking why something happens. I think we're also spending a great deal of time telling kids, okay, take what you've learned and apply it in new and novel situations. So we are trying to create a generation of thinkers.
A lot of the criticism of the public schools has led to a desire for choice among parents. And among those choices are charter schools. Even as public school enrollment has declined or stayed relatively stagnant, charter school enrollment, although it's small, has consistently risen, particularly in this state. And one of your predecessors claimed to welcome charter schools and the competition they provide. So they do take money from CMS. That's where that money to operate comes from. What's your view of charter schools?
You know, when charter schools were first kind of popping onto the scene, one of the things that they were touted to do was to kind of be that fertile ground for innovation that the traditional schools could learn from and then apply. I don't see a lot of that. What I see is a lot of the same, but with a kind of a select group of kids that they've either sorted through or come to because parent choice. So if you ask me, do I support charters? I do support the concept of innovation. I support some of the great charter schools that are out there. I think there's a place for them, as I think there's a place for private and parochial schools as well. I think there's a great place for private schools. I think there's a rich milieu. I think that's the right word. Thank you. Thank you very much. Help me. So much for academic vocabulary and public radio. I just kind of blew the whole interview. But anyway, my point would be that I think there's plenty of space for all. But I will also tell you that I said recently in a forum that I really see my role as the superintendent is to become the choice. So if I put charter schools out of business, if I put private or parochial schools out of business, not because of a philosophical disagreement that they have a right to exist, but because my service is better, then that's I see my role as.
But aren't the public schools handicapped? If the idea truly is to have these charter schools come on board, find new innovative ways to get through to children so that they succeed beyond what they might have succeeded at in the public schools, and the public schools look at that, and they really can't adopt some of those techniques because it's simply either prohibited by statute or they can't do that on a mass scale where they have to accept everybody.
Well, the deck is stacked. There's no doubt about it. I mean, the accountability processes in the state are really aligned towards private schools. I get that. But at the same time, it is the rules that I have to play under.
So you started, as all superintendents that I know of at least have, in the classroom. As a teacher in Illinois, this is a long time ago, but what did you teach? What grade? What subject?
I first taught a self-contained sixth grade classroom, and then I moved to teach a third and fourth grade classroom in Iowa, a combination classroom. I ultimately ended up teaching 16 years of middle school science.
Wow. Why did you leave? Because a lot of educators are there because they like teaching. They like helping kids learn. They want to see the light go on in those children's eyes. The light's on in your eyes right now as I talk about this. So why did you leave? To take on these thankless administrative jobs.
I do love being in the classroom. I do love being with kids. You know, I also coached high school basketball, college basketball. I've led forensic speaking teams. I mean, I really enjoy being around young people and the energy that they bring. But the question was, why did I leave? And I left because when I looked around at the people that were leading, the other people who felt like I did, I thought I could do a better job of that. So my first principalship was really a difficult step for me. But it was one that I thought I had to take to support the other teachers, and I thought I could have a greater impact on more kids by being a principal. I was a principal who spent an awful lot of time in the classrooms with kids, modeling how I wanted instruction to go. At some point, I was asked to come and be a human resources officer in St. Johns County, Florida. And I thought, you know what? It's the logical next step. I can not only now affect one school, but I can affect many schools by the selection of principals who are like-minded, who want to spend time in classrooms working with teachers hand in hand to elevate kids. Ultimately, that work, we were incredibly successful in St. Johns County. It was a school district that was very highly regarded in Florida. That led to a superintendent asking me to come to Baton Rouge. He got terminated, and I think people saw the work that I had done and said, you know what, would you be our interim superintendent? Mm-hmm. And there I saw the opportunity to impact education in Baton Rouge. There we ended the nation's longest continually litigated desegregation case. We improved scores for students across the board. We improved graduation rates. We passed a bond referendum. That led to going to another larger school district, and that was in St. Petersburg, Florida. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's interesting is I loved St. Petersburg. It was a great school district, but that ultimately led to New York City. That ultimately led to Washington County and now here.
Dr. Clayton Wilcox is superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. He's our guest for the hour. We're coming right back after this break at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Duke Energy, committed to building a smarter energy future for the Carolinas. More at duke-energy.com/future. And Quala Mutual Arts and Crafts Incorporated, presenting the Open Air Indian Art Market August 26th from 9 to 4, featuring Cherokee artists and crafts. Details at visitcherokeenc.com. White supremacists see President Trump as someone who understands them after he equated the counter-protesters in Charlottesville with neo-Nazis and other extremists. Former Klan leader David Duke praised the president for his honesty and courage to tell the truth. So, coming up in 20 minutes to 10 o'clock during On Point, they'll be taking a closer look at the white supremacy movement in America today. That's all upcoming. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's your time at CharlotteTalks at WFAE.org or on Twitter at CharlotteTalks. We're coming right back.
When you're catching up on the day's news, the headlines are a good place to start. But to really understand the world and what's happening, you want the full story. All Things Considered takes the time to explore the details and differences to find meaning in the day's biggest stories. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
At 90.7 WFAE, at WFAE.org, and find us on Facebook and Twitter.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Clayton Wilcox, our guest, the new superintendent of Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. He took over on July 1st. You just referenced the busing for desegregation situation in Baton Rouge, where you were the superintendent for a while. Busing to achieve integration here stopped because the courts declared our system to be unitary. Even in the face of school board members at the time saying, no, we are not, please don't stop this. But since that time, our schools have been resegregated. And part of the reason for this school assignment plan that they labored over last year, or part of this year, has been to eliminate these serious pockets of poverty that were identified in our schools. In Louisiana, where the system had been under court-ordered busing, you petitioned the courts to declare that system unitary, and you said that equitable resources were more important than demographics. You said this case was filed on behalf of black children because they didn't have the resources to get the right education. I think if you asked them, they did not file for the right to sit next to white children. Is that what you said?
That's what I said.
Okay. But you're also reported as saying, I believe it's important for young people to go to school with students different from them in terms of race, in terms of economics, and thought, because we live in a diverse world. So which is it? Those two statements seem to be at odds with each other.
Well, it's both. It really is both. And they are at odds because of the housing patterns that we choose to live in. I guess really what that says is that many of the problems that manifest themselves in schools are not created in and of the schools. They're created in our larger society. You know, I will tell you, it wasn't original to me to say that this desegregation case in Baton Rouge was not for black kids to sit next to white kids. That was told to me by multiple black citizens in Baton Rouge.
Okay.
Citizens who said all we wanted was access to the same resources that the rich white kids had across town.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we saw, excuse me, in Baton Rouge was that we were spending literally millions of dollars a year on court monitors, on busing that was having an arguably ineffective solution in Baton Rouge. Because what had happened in Baton Rouge is parents had voted with their feet. Baton Rouge at the time of the original busing order and desegregation case was about 70% white, 30% black in terms of the school system. When I was the superintendent there, we were just reversed. We were about 70% black students and 30% white. Literally, some black students couldn't go to school in their neighborhood schools because they were being bused to schools that had been predominantly white, not because it was going to achieve a desegregation effect, but because we had these stringent court orders that said that black and white kids had to go to school irrespective of who was bearing the brunt of that.
You have said from the beginning that you want to ultimately make CMS a district of choice. Does that mean choice within the school system itself? I want my kid to go here, or that you want the system itself to be the parent's choice, not a charter, not a private, but the schools, the public schools?
I want this public school system to be the place where parents say, we can get a great education for our kids, we choose to go to a CMS school. Within that, I want the neighborhood school that parents are closest to be a great option for them. So if they choose a magnet or a boutique school, it's not out of fear, it's not out of anger, it's not out of angst. It's because they believe they can get something else for their kids. It's kind of that and plus.
This is an unfair question because you literally just got here, but where are we on the timeline to making that a reality?
I won't say it's unfair, but it is probably not a question that I can answer accurately, but okay. I would just say this. If this thing is a 100-yard dash, we're still on our side of the field. We're still probably at the 20 or 30-yard line.
In Hagerstown, Maryland, the system you just left, you were reportedly admired, but you did have some detractors who faulted you over an alleged lack of commitment to boosting teacher pay. Now, the teacher workforce there, unlike here, was unionized. And so they have a particular point of view on all of this. Is that part of the issue here? What is your feeling about teacher pay? Are our teachers underpaid?
I think generally teachers are underpaid for the work that they do. Let me go back to Hagerstown for a second. The people who said I wasn't committed to teacher raises negate the fact that we increased teacher compensation every single year during my time there. We simply didn't give enough. You know, if we were giving 3 to 3.5%, people wanted 7%. That was not within our economic possibility.
Was that based on tenure? Was it based on experience? Was it based on educational level? Was it based on performance?
All those things. We had a number of schools that were in a TIF grant where there were teacher incentive grants for those young people. Those were federal dollars. They were targeted at some of our hardest to staff schools. But we also there had a salary schedule that reflected both your experience in the classroom and your academic standing, whether you had a master's degree or a doctoral degree or even a degree status in between both the master's and the doctor's called a specialist degree.
The school board there in Hagerstown credited you with putting iPads in the hands of all 3 through 12th grade students and creating middle school partnerships with community colleges and forming a partnership to provide nursing services to the students in those schools. Are those the things that you're most proud of?
I think they are the things I'm most proudest of as initiatives. I think what I'm proudest of, however, is that we spent a great deal of time talking about our special needs students and that we actually improved the services to the point that many of our young people who were receiving those services early on exited those services.
In Pinellas, Florida, you were there during the implementation of and probably the planning process of a student assignment plan, not unlike what Ann Clark, your predecessor, just went through here. How did their process and the results there differ from our process? We don't have any results yet, so we can't talk about that.
You know, I think that book is still being written, the chapters of that book. We had a number of schools that it was reported here when I came that were the St. Pete Times did an expose that was 12,000 words.
Called Failure Factory.
Failure Factories. Five of my elementary schools, Maximo Elementary School, a couple of other schools. What they didn't talk about was the 100-plus other schools that actually did have academic gains. So I think it is possible to do what we're setting out to do. This is phase one of the student assignment plan where parents are voluntarily choosing specialized programs. Phase two is coming up next year. We're in the process of designing that. So I think the tale of the tape is yet to be told, but I believe if we implement with fidelity, we can create great schools.
Let me share with you some things that have come in from listeners as we've been talking here. Justin emails, what resources can Dr. Wilcox commit to investing in our older campuses to send the message that we care about all of our students and believe that they are all worthy of investment?
I think if you look at the proposal that we have, you'll see that we have a very nice blend of retrofitting, remodeling, repairing, renovating a number of our older schools, our city center schools. We also are going to address some of the growth needs in southeast and southwest Charlotte.
There's also a part two to that question. How will Dr. Wilcox work to raise their educational experience to match that of students who attend CMS campuses in more affluent areas?
Again, we're trying to make sure that we have great teachers everywhere. We're investing in professional development. We are talking about using technology as a force multiplier. So I think all of those things have to come together. I'm not somebody who believes in silver bullets. I do believe in silver BBs.
Kim on Twitter says asks, can Dr. Wilcox share his thoughts on testing? For example, at the high school level, two-thirds of your grade is based on tests and formal assessments. What do you think about testing?
I think right now we're over-tested and we're under-taught. And so one of the things that I've already asked is that we're doing an analysis on the amount of testing that's going on in the Charlotte schools and the Mecklenburg County schools. And we're looking to eliminate or reduce some of the testing.
How much control do you have over that? Isn't some of that state and nationally mandated?
The state and nationally mandated tests, we can't do anything about, but sometimes in prepping for those tests, we bring other tests to fray. So I think we've got to look at all of that.
Lucia on Facebook, what is Dr. Wilcox's view of Betsy DeVos and her goals for public education under the current administration?
I'm not really very supportive of this time.
Because she's in favor of private schools?
No, because I don't think she understands the issues that are pressing upon most of us. I don't think she understands the very real challenges of funding. I don't think she understands the very real challenges of poverty for young people. I don't think she really understands why public schools are important to the democracy.
Why are they?
I think because it's the one place where we all come together. I think it's the place where we have the opportunity to talk about our shared and common history. I think it's where we learn hard work. I think it's where we learn to be enterprising young people. I think public schools are the last great institution of the republic, and we need to preserve them.
Your opinion of Dr. DeVos and her philosophy, are you an outlier, or is that an opinion widely shared by people in your position around the country, or do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. Helen on Facebook, since Dr. Wilcox values information and media literacy, how strong is his commitment to help to keeping media specialists in the schools?
I absolutely am committed to keeping media specialists in the schools, but I think media specialists are going to have to change in what they do. They can't be simply the sole custodians of archive materials. I think they have to advance to using digital media. I think they have to advance to making sure that they are really doing outreach work. They're not waiting for kids to come to them. They're taking great books and literacy to kids.
I just called her Dr. DeVos. I'm not sure she
I don't believe she is.
Okay. There you go. Mike emails, many school districts that have issues with community support have focused on improving the quality of the cookie, but have forgotten the fortune. The story is why the fortune cookie is still so popular. I would be interested in hearing how Dr. Wilcox intends to rewrite the CMS fortune to make people of our community feel differently about the school system. I guess you modernized the fortune so people will eat the cookie.
Well, I think that's what we've talked about for the last hour. We actually have to focus on the main business. The main business is kids' academic achievement. I think if we focus on academic achievement for all kids, we provide the resources that all kids can achieve to high levels. If we do inspire them to chase career paths or chase college education in a way that makes a difference, mm-hmm. then we will be that. I guess the nugget with inside the fortune cookie. I don't have the familiarity with the food.
You gave all these kids three through 12th grade iPads when you were in Hagerstown. I'm not sure people who went to school when I did in the Pleistocene age understand why that's important. What's wrong with books? What's wrong with spiral notebooks? Why do they need to have these pads? And if they do need to have these pads and other technology like that, do we have access to that at CMS, or is that something you're going to have to talk people into bringing on board?
Well, first of all, great books are important, right? Opening a book is kind of a magical experience. It allows kids to be transported away. I don't think you get that same experience with a device.
Right.
At the same time, the device is really a window to the world. The device allows a teacher to do things that they can't normally do. Let me give you but one example. If you're an art teacher and you're talking about the great painters of the Impressionist era, you're probably not going to have a Monet sitting in your classroom. You're not going to have some of these other paintings there. But you can visit the Museum d'Orsay. You can take your kids on a virtual tour. You can help those young people understand that. That plays out in subject after subject after subject. If you're a band teacher or a symphonic band teacher and you want to hear the great works of some of the great composers, You know, if you can't play them yourself, you can transport kids there in real time. Mm-hmm. So I think technology is a force multiplier. That's why I think we have to use it.
And do we have those resources available in our schools at the moment?
Well, interestingly, we have over 100,000 Chromebooks, but they're an internet appliance. And so if the young person doesn't have the internet at home, it doesn't do them any good. So one of the things we've done in the last probably 90 days is announced a partnership with Sprint where we're going to provide internet devices for young people who come from impoverished backgrounds so they can access the resources at home.
You have said that in your short time here, you've learned a great deal about the personality of the school system. How would you describe that personality?
Is anybody listening to this?
Because nobody listens.
Okay. You know, I think that in some ways we're a bit too defensive. We don't take criticism well. I think we're a great school district, but at the same time, even the great can become better. I think we have to listen to our critics. It's sometimes painful. I will tell you, in my first few days, seeing myself as a cartoon character really wasn't the most happy time around my house. But I kind of got through the characterization and said, well, what are they saying? And once you begin to look at that, you can become better.
Are you referring to editorial cartoons or are you the way you have been portrayed generally in the media since you arrived?
You know, honestly, the media has been fair to me, but the editorial cartoons were a little hard to take.
Yeah. But you will find that, and I'm not sure this is the way it really is elsewhere, despite the fact that we don't believe, as we've talked about earlier in this program, that we have this national good reputation. We focus in this city at a degree I've never witnessed before on education within the media. You have a dedicated reporter at the Charlotte Observer, Ann Doss-Helms. He does great work. We have a dedicated education reporter here at WFAE. We've done more shows than I can. We've probably done more shows on education than anything, any other topic we've ever covered. The focus on education and the public schools in this city is beyond anything I've seen. Is that so far, can you tell if that's true?
I think that's true.
Can you explain that?
I think it goes to the fascination that people have with education, and I hope that it would go.
Well, why don't they have that in Hagerstown or in Pinellas County, Florida, or in Baton Rouge or any place else you've been?
You know, I think part of it is that there's a sense of possibility here, and I think people understand that to achieve that possibility, we have to have great public schools. So people are going to look at us, and people are going to say, what does it take to make you better?
What can people do to make you succeed?
Well, I think one of the first things they can do is understand why we're asking for this bond referendum money. I think people can look to us in terms of providing their intellectual support to us beyond their capital dollars and that. We need people to come and inspire kids. We need, you know, corporate partnerships. We need average citizens to come in and say, you know, let me help you with your literacy challenge. Let me read to kids. Let me help teach them. You know, we've got some great examples of people that are doing great things. There's a woman in this community called Pam Grundy who's helping us with real gardens and helping us to make kids understand where their food's coming from. That's what we need.
I wish we had more time because I wanted to talk about the culinary manager and what that person is going to do. But we don't have any more time. You can educate me off the air.
I'll come back.
All right. Dr. Clayton Wilcox, who is the new superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. He started July 1st. The buses hit the road for their trial runs on Monday. When does school actually start?
The 28th.
All righty. Get ready for the traffic. Thank you for being here. Thanks for the hour.
Thank you.